Welcome to the Predictable Revenue Podcast, where sales leaders teach you what's working for them and how you can build it yourself.
This episode of the Predictable Revenue Podcast is brought to you by our sales coaching and consulting services. Are you looking to create repeatable, scalable, and predictable revenue? We've helped thousands of companies grow their business with tailored expert advice backed by testing to ensure they establish the best practices that'll work for them. Head over to bit.ly/predictable revenue coaching to learn more. When business leaders are going out and looking for investment for the first time, it can feel like a mysterious, confusing process. When in reality, if you've been selling your product to B2B customers, you've already learned everything you need to know. I'm your host, Sarah Hicks. And today on the Predictable Revenue Podcast, I'm going to be chatting with an expert about how the seller's journey maps to raising investment. He's a successful entrepreneur, technology visionary, and founder and former vice chairman of CloudReach, as well as executive chairman and founder of sales tech business Savvy.co. He has over 23 years of international experience in the IT industry across sales, business development, and product marketing, working for blue chip companies like Cisco, Ericsson, Nokia, and more. Pontus Naren, welcome to the Predictable Revenue Podcast.
Thank you, Sarah. It's great to be here.
So tell me, kind of walking back from the top, where did you first get this idea that you could map that seller's journey to the journey to investment?
Well, I mean, I spent majority of my career prior to starting my business, CloudReach, also in sales and sales leadership roles. And, you know, being a new business in the beginning, I was doing all the selling as well as running the business for the first few years. So I got quite extensive experience in selling to enterprise, to large enterprises. And you know, the way you go about that, of course, is you're trying to find a bunch of leads, people you can speak to, people you think are interested in what you can provide, whether it's products or services, etc. And they get whittled down, some of them fall off the sides, so to speak, as you go on your selling endeavors. And at some point, you reach a point where you have to do the contracts and all the details and sign things off. So all that was very, very known to me. And then we got to a point where a decision was taken to see if we can raise investment or even sell a large chunk of the business. And that's, I guess, a journey in its own right in terms of going out there, speaking to 15, 20, 25 different investors and potential kind of growth equity companies who we thought could be interested in buying a slice of CloudReach. And it started with doing exactly the same thing, right? In terms of finding a bunch of them, speaking to all of them, some of them fall away early on, some of them stick around and so on. But fast forwarding, at the very end, when I looked back at that whole journey, I realized the two processes map exactly. But at the beginning, when I started talking to investors, it felt like as an entrepreneur, I'm walking into a totally unfamiliar world where I've never ventured in before. And therefore, I have to behave in a different way, say different things, etc. And the whole process of how do you get from a first meeting with an investor to actually signing an investment agreement, right? And the terminology used throughout is very different. So I thought I was about to learn something totally new, was in reality, when the process was all done and dusted and wrapped up in February 17, and I look back at it, it maps almost 100% onto what I would call a classic enterprise B2B sales process.
Awesome. Well, let's walk our audience through that process from the beginning, building that framework as we go, talking about that seller's piece and then that going for the raise piece.
Yeah, I mean, if we start with a B2B journey, right? I mean, it's standard in that you either have to go out and generate your own leads by proactively contacting companies and whatever you do. You find them through trade shows. We had a very close relationship with Amazon Web Services and Google. So a lot of the leads we got came through from them. But you start with the first meeting. You have to, you know, give an introduction to the company, say a few clever things, talk about some case studies and why you're a reliable partner to work with. You know, the customer take their time. They think it through step by step. They come back to you. Have a few more meetings. You get to a point when they say, okay, you are actually someone we can work with. You start scoping out the work they're trying to do. If this, in this case, was a consulting project, and as you sit down, you understand their requirements. You know, what kind of help do they need, and do should we own it? Should they own it, etc. You get to the point of making a proposal, and you know the proposal goes out. They review it. They have a few back and forths on that, and so on. And then eventually, they come back and say, "Yeah, all good. Budget signed off. We understand the scope. We like it." You sign a framework services agreement, you send that across, you negotiate that back and forth. And, you know, we had one company here in the UK, as an example, we had, I think it was 37 or 38 terms on the contract. That's a lot of back and forth. And attached to the contract was an SOW or an order form, we called it, that set out the detail of the services. And eventually we came to a point of an agreement. And at that stage, you send it out via DocuSign or whatever, and everyone signs off when you move into execution mode. I mean, that's the classic enterprise sales process, right? And if you take that and you think, okay, that's pretty obvious. I'm an entrepreneur. I'm out there. I'm selling stuff. That's what we do. And you start thinking, okay, how do I get hold of these investors? And what would they speak to us? In our case, we engaged an investment banker who, helped us kind of prepare the pitch deck, but in the language that investors understand. I mean, you today, if you're a company, you have a pitch deck like that you take to the first meeting with a new client to try and showcase what you can do. We did the same thing, talk about the industry, the company, et cetera. I'm sure a few people have seen the pitch deck. And once you have that, you go to the investor, in this case, the investment banker were the lead generation house for us, right? So they arranged the meetings with 20, 25 different investors. In the same way, you turn up on the day, you tell the stories, you go through the pitch deck. And from the first meeting, yes, it's always different in that you're trying to get someone to pay money for your company and so on. But like a customer will look at you and think, can I work with you? Is there a level of trust here? Can we build a relationship that goes kind of beyond the day we sign the contract? So in that sense, it's exactly the same. And you go through it, you speak to a bunch of them. Some of these leads, like in the B2B sales world, will go away. They only ever became leads. They never really moved to the next stage. You get to the next stage, you go into more detail like you would with a client, and you start going into different parts of your business. How is it structured? Who do you employ? The same thing will happen on the B2B sales side. They will ask, who do you employ? Who's going to run the project for me? So literally every step of the way is the same. Now we come to a B2B sales motion. You would at some point get to a point where your proposal goes out, where you can sit down some detail. It's a somewhat legally binding document, the proposal in most cases. You can't quite say what you like in there. And there's a reasonable level of detail in terms of scope. And the equivalent in the investment world for me would be the term sheet, right? A term sheet is not that legally binding, but it gives you a level of detail in terms of how the relationship would work and what we're exchanging money for once we get to the point of signing the contract. So again, you have proposal on one side, term sheet on the other. It's essentially the same thing. And then you get through what could be a lengthy legal negotiation, because once the term sheet is signed, like a proposal is being agreed, rather than on the B2B selling side, you will send out SOWs and framework services agreement. Here you have a shareholders agreement, you have a share purchase agreement, different terminology, same thing. And you go through that, it could be 4, 6, 8, 10 weeks, lots of back and forth with legal teams, nailing down all the details that, of course, sets out the relationship beyond the point of signing. But when you look back at it, the lawyers might be different. You don't have contract lawyers, you have corporate lawyers, and so on and so forth. But you can really map this all the way. And I guess my main point is that when, if you're an entrepreneur, you're out there, you're very comfortable in what you're doing, you're running your business, you're growing your business, you have a lot of interaction with customers and everything, and you wander into a world which you feel is very unknown to you, people shouldn't be hesitant or scared, so to speak, and think, oh, this is something I'm so unfamiliar with. The only thing that changes is rather than selling your company's products and services to a customer, an enterprise, you're selling your company's shares to an investor. And that's essentially it. Otherwise, I'd say more or less the same.
Yeah, absolutely. So having been through this process yourself and now looking back on it with that kind of framework, where do you think that most founders or business leaders going through this make their mistakes or get tripped up?
I think that the thing that I remember looking back, I mean, this is now a few years ago, this was essentially 2016, second half of 2016, is that you're sitting there and like most business people, you're trying to predict where this is going to end up, right? What are we going to have to do? What are we going to do next? How do you get it closed off, et cetera? And therefore, you feel a bit lost at sea, so to speak, because you've never done it before. And I think if you think about it the sales process, you know what the customer is up to. Because you go there, you have the meetings, you scope things out, you figure out the product, you do a demo, you do a POC, whatever it might be. Proposal goes in. What happened to the proposal? The proposal will go to a person or a group of people, like, as I say, a steering committee. And the steering committee will sit down and look at that. Well, yeah, that looks good. I've covered all the bases. Do we know it's going to work for us? Can we integrate it with the existing environment? Do we have budgets for this? Do we think it's value for money? You know, they go through all of these things. On the other side, you can change, you keep the word committee, but rather than steering, it becomes investment. So, you know, we had the investor that that acquired a large part of my company, Blackstone, that had an investment committee at the beginning of January. We closed the actual transaction in the middle of February. And, you know, because I thought I couldn't figure out how this process was working, I always felt like I was kind of a step behind or slightly in the dark. Well, actually, had I thought about it in the same way, I was like, okay, at some point, this proposal, the term sheet, will have to go to an investment committee. Once the investment committee says yes, then they're going to spend money on legal and more finance due diligence, et cetera, in the same way as the customer will spend money on legal and maybe some finance due diligence and so on. So I think it's just the thinking and the knowledge that as an entrepreneur, so long as you just every step of the way think of yourself being in an enterprise sales situation, accepting there are a few terms you might be unfamiliar with, but otherwise, you know, it is the same thing.
Yeah. And how did you kind of deal with, I suppose, those false positives and kind of understanding who might stick around for the entire length of that pipeline, the investor pipeline, when we're thinking of it that way?
Wow. Yeah, I often say that, you know, investors are so keen, they are so interested until the day they are not, and then they're gone in a flash, basically. And I think it is very difficult, right, to really figure this out. I think, you know, again, the classic science, if you're selling it to customers, you get a feel pretty quickly if you have a bit of experience that is there a cultural match? You know, do you feel comfortable in each other's presence, basically? Do we think we have kind of on the same wavelength? Do we agree where the market is going and therefore buying my company and taking a big, you know, make a big investment in my company makes sense? So when you're talking about these things, do you have an understanding? I think in a lot of cases, in a lot of the conversations I walked into, I felt, especially in kind of first meeting scenarios, that after an hour of talking, I've just been educating them on my market. And pretty much every time that happened, they fell away. Because unless they came to the meeting with a good to really good understanding of what we were doing, my company's role in the market, why would we be different? Or what should a company in that market do? Or how should they look to be different to make this investment make sense, right? If you're sitting there and all you're doing is educating the investor, I'd say you should, 99% of the cases, write them off.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. And I would say that piece of it maps as well to the seller's journey, because thinking about from an outbound perspective where you're reaching out to people, and we know that 95% of those people are not ready to purchase because they just haven't even considered what we're about to offer them. But there are that 5% that are already kind of considering that maybe that problem they're thinking about, is there a solution? And then they basically are understanding the environment that this sort of problem exists in, and you're coming in and providing that solution. And that's exactly the same. These are investors that are already thinking about that gap in the market, thinking about that problem, thinking about those solutions. And then if you have it, they're more likely to want to invest in you.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think they need to be already quite mature in their thinking, basically. Mm-hmm. If this, and I guess this is why, you know, a lot of people, which we didn't really do, to be honest with you, but a lot of the advice people gave us, you have to get out there early, speak to investors, educate them on what you're doing, why you're doing it, what's the market you're going after, why does it make sense? You know, how do you differentiate to others? You know, have you seen a new problem that no one has solved? Have you taken an existing one and sold it in a different way? You know, whatever that is, the reason why it might be worth spending that time, of course, is that that might trigger the investor to go out to actually do that groundwork. So if you come back six months later or 9 months later saying, hey, you know, the conversation we had, what do you think? And they go, yeah, you know, you told us something that really made us think. We spent a lot of time on this now. We love this space, right? I think that's probably the argument for why you should go out and speak to people, especially if you're in a market like, you know, when we were in cloud integration, kind of cloud managed services, 2015, 2016, it was a very immature market. Mm-hmm. People needed time. Very few people in the investment industry had foresight at the time to really think this through.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And even that piece of it is like getting marketing out there to educate before you come in and try to sell it. You mentioned that you had an investment banker who, when we kind of look at that analogy, was sort of your lead gen expert. And that person sort of helped you connect with all those investors. What do you think the sort of benefit was to having that person do that for you? And what are some of the risks maybe associated with having an investment banker?
Yeah, I mean, the benefits, of course, is that, sorry, they generally do have a pre-built network, so to speak, and where they have connections into both strategic buyers, if you want to actually go and sell your companies in entirety, and they have connections to all the major investors out there, where they know how to get to the major investors. And they therefore also take off some heavy lifting, you know, they help out driving the NDAs, signed, and you know, all that good stuff, as well as building the financial model that we needed, the pitch deck, refine the pitch deck, and so on. So in that initial phase, they did a lot of heavy lifting and help and the outreach, etc. So that was super helpful. Then I'd say there's a period of time where you actually have to do the hard yards yourself. You're out there selling, pushing, cajoling, you know, all that good stuff. And then you ideally get to a point where someone says, you know what, this could be of interest to us. We want to produce a term sheet and see if we can reach an agreement. This is when these guys came back in, because yes, both, sometimes it's good to be a step removed from some of the, I wouldn't say nasty conversations, but you know what I mean? Things can get a bit heated. So it's good to have someone else to kind of shield you from that. And yes, there are, of course, elements, you know, I'm comparing this to the journey of a kind of enterprise sales motion being very similar. It is, there are a lot of similarities. There are also differences. So the investment bank in knowing the subtleties, the language, the potential pitfalls, etc., is very useful to have someone there to you feel protected, right? Like you have a lawyer or accountants to protect your business for other reasons. Then, of course, at the very, very end, there's a lot of final 2, 3, 4 weeks of legal heavy lifting and negotiation to kind of round off the deal. Again, they were very, very helpful. Mm-hmm. And on the risk side, I'd say what I didn't know, maybe I'm slightly careful what I say here, but you know, some investors, not all, we'll probably view some investment bankers, not all, with a dose of suspicion in that investors would say, if your company is that good in that market with amazing metrics and everything, you shouldn't have to go to someone like an investment banker, because the risk is that the investors perceive the investment bankers kind of polishing something that is not as good as they make it seem. So mm-hmm. Lose a bit of trust potentially in that moment. And they might, yeah, just think that you struggle to get traction directly with investors. So you had to go to investment banker, and because people should treat that as a fallback, etc. So therefore, is there something in here in the company that is not obvious, you know, on the surface, but when we dig into it, we're going to find something we don't like. So therefore, we're not going to, you know, spend time with these guys. And that could be a potential signal that you send by using an investment banker that obviously can potentially not be helpful to you. So yeah, I mean, there are arguments for both for using them and against.
Yeah, absolutely. We mentioned right at the beginning that one of the biggest kind of challenges and why there is such mystery going on when, you know, founders or business leaders are going out for investment is that they don't have visibility into what's happening on the other side of the table. And that's one of the things, of course, that you have decided to solve. So tell us about that.
Well, in terms of savvy, you mean? Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's in the B2B sales process. So you know, we started this company just over a year ago, actually taking on a different piece of software There was more to do with social media and helping salespeople become more efficient in how they interact with customer over social media. And what we realized relatively quickly was actually salespeople don't really care about social media and lead generation. So whilst the product that we were handed and with the revenue associated was a very good product, it didn't solve the problem that the intended users agreed was a problem. So therefore, in short, you don't have a business. So we decided, okay, fair enough, salespeople, we agree with you. This is not a problem worth solving. But what could be a problem worth solving? And we had a lot of debate and disagreements and ideation and everything internally, and thought, you know, if you think about the kind of typical enterprise sales process, where are the frictions? You know, what is it that makes you maybe not successful, right? And makes it more painful than it should be? And it became pretty obvious pretty quickly that whilst most of the world has moved on and you collaborate and you work in new, exciting, interesting ways, salespeople use a technology that's been with us since the 70s, maybe even before, namely email. I mean, you go to all your meetings, you have all these discussions. What do? You go back and you send an email and another email and another email. And of course, in the 90s, when I started working, that was a very, very exciting, cool thing to use because you can send something very quickly and not via post. Nowadays, it's a real hindrance because whether you're using Miro or Figma or, you know, other online real-time collaboration tool, Google Workspace and Google Docs, etc., that's what people expect today, that it's real-time, it's online, it's collaborative, everyone is looking at the same information. Why? Because it speeds things up. I mean, there are probably still people out there who send documents around to people, to a group of 10 people. You end up with version 1.1.2, 1.3.5. Mm-hmm. And then it's like, oh, who's editing the current version? Not realizing you can go to Google Docs and just write it together and you don't have to circulate anything. And you save yourself probably 90% of the time it took to circulate that document. So what's the equivalent in the sales world? Well, we said, well, why email anything? Where essentially we have built a platform where when the supplier can actually instigate through our platform savvy a conversation with a customer and follow up to a meeting or, you know, whatever the trigger point was, share all the documentation, share everything you need to be shared, and the customer can log on. We will see when they log on. They can reshare the documentation with other people internally. They can ask questions. They can request you to take action. They can ask for more information, et cetera, and essentially drive the whole process through this platform. And as we keep developing it, we will allow customers to upload documentation. We'll keep track of versions of contracts that you negotiate, et cetera. But essentially, soup to nuts, from first meeting, the contract closed, everything sits in one place that you can access and look at. And, you know, we are working currently with, say, medium-sized suppliers where a sales team consists of a salesperson, pre-sales, product sales specialists, and project management, maybe some engineering. Mm-hmm. So I don't know, 3, 4, 5, 7, 8 people. On the customer side, there could be at least high single digit, if not tens, dozens of people. And if you do all that over email over a 3, 4, 5, 6 month time, that's a lot of email and a lot of information gets lost.
Yeah.
So our system help you to kind of centralize all of that, drive the process through, check what you need to complete the transaction. Everyone knows what's going on. What are the next step? Whose court is the ball in? That's what we're trying to drive at. And we are, you said sales tool. It is a sales tool. It's also a buying tool. So what we're trying to do is not just to help the supplier. We are parking Savvy firmly in the middle as a tool that accelerates B2B transactions for the buyer and the seller. And that's our mission.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Very cool. And is this something that could be used, I mean, either now or in future, for visibility in the investment journey as well?
Well, interestingly enough, so we have an investor on board. We have some really experienced investors. But in the process, of course, finding those investors, we spoke to some other investors. And what is interesting, you know, what the investors do is, of course, they raise money from what they call their LPs, the limited partners. So will they create the fund and say, I want to raise $250 million. I want to go out and find people who want to put money into my fund. And here's our thesis. These are the companies we're going to invest in, et cetera. they also have to sell their fund and their performance of previous funds and what people should put money in now. And when they saw Savvy and the, how it works and everything, they said, hang on a second, we should use your platform to raise money for our fund. So, you know, we are making it very focused around B2B transactions, you know, suppliers selling into enterprise. But, you know, there's nothing even today stopping people from using it for other purposes. And I think we'll see people in the fullness of time also use it maybe to raise funds for investment or to go and pitch to investors. Obviously, we communicate just over Savvy with our investors.
Yeah. Yeah. Makes sense. Okay. And okay. Going back to just our original idea, which is just letting, you know, business leaders know how to go out there and seek investment in the best way possible, the most scalable way, the most sort of the most systematized way, I suppose. What is the very first thing that they should do today to kind of get started on that journey, if that's something they want to do?
Well, I think, you know, in the same way as when you built the company that you're running today, you have to come up with a value proposition, you know, and a product or a set of services, whatever it is that you are selling, and think that through, and also think about the market you're trying to target, and, you know, who are these people, what do they care about? It's the same thing, right? You're going to go and speak to a bunch of investors who are your customers, and that's how you should see them. You need to create that pitch. Why should they invest in you? And, you know, what is that you bring to market that's unique, and you know, what are you going to use the money for, and so on and so forth. So creating that pitch is clearly what you need to do on the off. You know, whether you engage an investment banker or you do it yourself, you need to create a very, very clear picture in your mind. You know, why should anyone care about what you have to offer?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, perfect place to wrap it up. Thank you so much for joining us, Pontus, on the show. If people want to learn more from you, if they want to learn more about Savvy, where can they do that?
Well, you can, of course, go to savvy.co, which is our website, or we're on LinkedIn and Twitter. And yeah, if anyone is interested, then ping me on LinkedIn. You'll find me there. And I'm very happy to connect with anyone who wants to know more about this and have any questions about what I talked about.
Perfect. Well, thanks again for joining us. It was really great. And thank you to all of you for joining us for another episode of the Predictable Revenue Podcast. Please, if you haven't already, hit that subscribe button on YouTube so that you can be notified each week when we have great guests like Pontus Noren joining us to share all the tips and tricks about investment, sales, marketing, all those things. We'll catch you again next time. Thank you.